Tonight, snow is likely. We could see an accumulation of up to 1 inch. Look for a low of 25. The wind will be light and out of the northwest. Tomorrow, decreasing clouds, the high 32 with a wind out of the northwest from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, clear and cold, the low 13. The wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Saturday, sunny with a high in the upper 20s. Saturday night through Sunday night, mostly clear with lows in the mid-20s and the high Sunday in the upper 30s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois ranged from the low 30s to the low 40s. Same went for the state of Indiana. At Rockford, it was 33 degrees, also 33 at O'Hare. Bloomington reported 37 degrees, 38 at Mattoon, 42 at Carbondale. In South Bend, 34 degrees, Lafayette, 35, Indianapolis, 38, Terre Haute, 40. Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky at the top of the hour, 37 degrees, the dew point 32, the relative humidity 82%. The wind, that information was missing from the top of the hour report. The barometric pressure, 30.23 and falling. And at 12:38, 34 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Experts at the University of Illinois are weighing in on the 14-year sentence handed down yesterday to former Governor Rod Blagojevich. The chair of the Political Science Department on the U of I Chicago campus, former Chicago Alderman Dick Simpson, says while many public officials have been convicted of corruption, many more just didn't get caught. But he says the Blagojevich sentence is a good start in getting past years of corruption.
I'm optimistic we will make steps forward. There is no single silver bullet. We have to do an entire agenda of things, but I'm hopeful that the public will be willing to support the several-decade effort that it will take to clean house.
Simpson says lawmakers need to act on additional campaign finance legislation and other measures developed by Governor Pat Quinn's Commission on Ethics. Meanwhile, Robert Rich, who heads the Institute of Government and Public Affairs on the Urbana campus, says the former governor's sentence not only sends a message about cleaning up government, but also one about educating the public. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert spoke with Rich about his reaction to the Blagojevich prison sentence, beginning with the former governor's comments in the courtroom yesterday.
I think that the apologizing was very important. I think Judge Zagel was looking for some contrition on his part, although I would say a 14-year sentence is a lot different than the 3 or 4 that his counsel wanted. I would say that is a very strong sentence, and I think does send a very strong message.
We were hearing possibly much longer after the sentence for Tony Rezko. Will this send the message and change the culture, ultimately, of Illinois government?
I think that in terms of the culture of Illinois government, I think that Patrick Fitzgerald's work in general does that. I think people are clear that, Fitzgerald is after changing the culture and after sending strong messages, and I think Judge Zagel is as well. And I think that, you know, when you get above 10 years, which is above what Tony Rezko got, I think that you are sending a strong message.
We saw a statement, I don't know if you've seen it, from the state Republican Chair Pat Brady, and he says, I'll just read the sentence ends the Rob Blagojevich saga, but unfortunately, his enablers continue to burden the people of Illinois with financial mismanagement and higher taxes. Do you think that lawmakers or politicians did anything that allowed or encouraged these misdeeds?
You know, I think quote-unquote enablers is much too strong a term. Let's not forget that the people of Illinois elected Governor Blagojevich twice. So if you want to talk about enablers, you can talk about the people of Illinois, the electorate being an enabler as well. I think that what Governor Blagojevich did, he has been found guilty for, and I think that he's been given a strong sentence for.
That was my next question, actually. What's the responsibility of voters after this to the people that voted for Blagojevich twice, researched our candidates some more?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The media in the last election and his second election, if you go back and look, the media did a very good job bringing out the governor's record and raising questions about what he did and raising questions about his practices. The electorate chose not to listen to that. So if we want to change the culture of Illinois, I think it starts with more education. I think it starts with education at the K through 12 level, and I think that it also means the electorate pays more attention to issues as well. So I think a strong message has been sent. We're going to have to see in the future what the impact is in the culture.
Robert Rich is the director of the U of I's Institute for Government and Public Affairs. He spoke with Jeff Bossert. British mystery writer P.D. James is best known for her creation, Adam Dalgliesh, a pensive private Scotland Yard detective shaped by his own personal tragedy. Dalgliesh populates many of James' stories, but not her latest. In her new book, Death Comes to Pemberley, P.D. James inhabits the world of Jane Austen, specifically Pride and Prejudice. Death Comes to Pemberley picks up with Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy married and settled into the Darcy ancestral home. But as the title suggests, it's not quite happily ever after. NPR's Linda Wertheimer spoke with P.D. James about her new book and asked her why she decided to bring death to Pemberley.
I had this idea at the back of my mind that I'd like to combine my two great enthusiasms. One is for the novels of Jane Austen, and the second is for writing detective fiction. And it would be rather fun to marry them and set a book in Pemberley 6 years after Elizabeth and Darcy had married, when everything is going very well and they're very happy and they have two healthy and handsome boys in the nursery, and life is peaceful and ordered and, of course, rich and prosperous. And then comes the eruption of a rather ghastly murder in the Pemberley woodlands.
Well, I wonder if you were at all inspired by these, popular sequels, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, or Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters.
No. I hate to tell you, Linda, that I didn't even know they existed. And when I know it's absolutely true. And when I'd started, I said to my PA, would she look on the internet and find the computer? She does all these clever things, which I don't do, and see how many other people had written sequels. And we were amazed, absolutely amazed. And when we read some of the contents, well, I think they certainly should apologize to Jane Austen. I have tried to be very true to her characters and very true, as far as I can be, to the style of the book.
Well, now, you have kept the Pride and Prejudice cast of characters, although some are way in the background. But I was very pleased to see that the villain in your book is also Jane Austen's villain, the notorious Mr. Wickham.
Yes, I suppose we ought not really to let that be known. But indeed, I think everybody does know that he is the villain. But the great problem is, of course, will he escape being executed? So this is a great grief, because both Darcy and Elizabeth know that if this happened, there would be a terrible cloud over their marriage and over, indeed, their whole family.
Now, Jane and Fitzwilliam Darcy, on the eve of their famous annual ball, which is a major event in the county,
yes,
they learn that a murder has been committed on the grounds of their estate. In fact, Darcy discovers Wickham bending over the bloody body of the victim. So Darcy has an important role to play.
He has a very important part, and he believes Wickham to be innocent of this particular crime. But, of course, because Wickham is his brother-in-law, he feels a responsibility. Wickham, the hated Wickham, the Wickham who's done so much harm to him, has by this marriage come into the family, and he's faced with the awful possibility that he will be a witness for the prosecution in the trial.
You know, Elizabeth remains, although she's very much aware of her position in the county and so forth, she does remain a fairly spicy character in your book.
Yes, she does.
And she seems to kind of be reconsidering her attraction to Darcy and to acknowledge that perhaps she had been fairly calculating about it. You write in your book, Elizabeth knew she was not formed for the sad contrivances of poverty.
Yes. I don't think she married for money. Elizabeth did marry for love. I think she did love Darcy, and she grew to love him more. But she was not a woman who would allow herself to fall in love with a man who was totally penniless, because she felt she had responsibilities to her family. I think her aunt, her very wise aunt Gardiner, said, "Your father expects you to behave sensibly," and that simply meant to make a satisfactory marriage.
And you also spend some time on just those questions, the very limited choices that women can make in the early 19th century.
Absolutely. I mean, women were expected to marry. And if they didn't marry, that was regarded as a failure. And the only job that they could do outside the home would be going as a governess. And it was a horrible job because you were neither a servant nor were you the family. And we know how much it was dreaded, you know, from one of Jane Austen's other books, Emma. So marriage was tremendously important. And of course, the women were looking for men with money, but in fact, the men were looking for women with money. Money was, seems to me, tremendously important in Jane Austen.
Now, of course, there is a way in which your book is completely different from anything Austen ever would have attempted. A large portion of the book is a courtroom drama. And you also do spend some time on what they knew at that time about forensics. I mean, there are discussions of what was the cause of death. What could the weapon have been?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Scientific experiments were done by gentlemen, very often with money, in their country houses. This is a general practitioner, a doctor. He is the one that the investigating magistrate, Sir Selwyn Hardcastle, says to him, "I suppose you clever people can't tell us the difference between the blood from one body and the blood from another." And he says, "No, Sir Selwyn, we don't set out to be gods." And it would have seemed incredible to them that that could actually come. And they would have also been amazed, I think, to think that you could say who had last handled the firearm.
Now, I wonder if you have thought about continuing in this vein. I mean, death comes to Donwell Abbey or death at Delaford or something.
No, no, I hadn't at all. And it's interesting, really, Linda, you see, I had never thought that I would ever want to use somebody else's characters. If it hadn't been this idea that I would like to combine a novel which I knew very well and loved, although it's not my favourite Jane Austen one, Emma is, and my passion for writing detective fiction. I think, like most readers of Jane Austen, I often wonder what happens afterwards because they're so real to us. But no, this will be very much the one-off.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Well, thank you very much for talking to us about Death Comes to Pemberley.
Well, it's been lovely, Linda. It's been great talking to you.
Mystery novelist P.D. James, her latest book is Death Comes to Pemberley.
P.D. James spoke with NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
Have you turned to WILL to help keep you informed of current events in our country and around the world? You might turn to WILL to get up-to-date information about financial and agricultural markets. These are just a few examples of the range of programming services found on WILL. Please consider making an additional pledge of support today. Your gift will help us continue to